Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Kelly, you had me nervous there.
You were running up when we had to start the show. Can you believe
that? I don't
know
how to do the techno stuff. Well, I've only done it, like three times in our 2.5 years?
I am so sorry. I don't know what happened. I went to walk my dog. He was really slow. And the next thing I know, I was like, oh my God. And then there was traffic up the wazoo. Ugh. And it was like horrible. And then I was going to make like an illegal U-turn. And then there was a cop. And I'm like, oh, got to go to the next one. So I made it just in the nick of time.
Well, you're in luck. I'm in my Zen Buddhist state right now.
Good.
Such a lie. However, it sounded good. We could practice some of our previous guests' meditative.
Yes. Well, I was thinking I was thinking about the mindfulness people that we've had, and it's like, it's okay. It's going to be all right. It's going to work out, you know.
You know, it's one of those where it's what is the worst thing that could have happened?
Exactly.
So, well, the worst thing that happened was we started the show a minute and 20 seconds late in our audience. You guys love us, right? You didn't abandon us after that. You just sat there and said, what the fuck
is going on? Exactly.
All right. Well, here we are. How
it's
are you?
Worth the wait. Things are so good. I had such a great weekend with my parents. We went to Catalina.
Yes.
I love Catalina, except there was some dude who threw up on the boat.
Of course, you didn't see it. Thank goodness, because you would have been barfing right after.
So I did not see it, but no, it was really nice. It was a great little getaway, and everybody had a great time. So
you
and I were
talking. It's always that you have that sense of community when your parents are out here.
It's
like,
such
it
a
takes
sense,
a village, right?
And it's just the security. It's the safety. It was. Mm-hmm. I went through like a tough couple hours after they left. I was kind of down. I was like, oh, I miss them. And then like life got back to normal, but. But it's always really nice.
Yeah. Oh, good.
How about you?
Yeah. I'm doing good. We've had some excitement the last week. Chris is getting a promotion, and so it's been kind of an interesting thing. I'll tell you later about
it. But very
exciting. It's always are always the good problems to have when people are kind of fighting for you. So, yeah.
I love it.
So it's been fun. It's very positive for him because, you know, he's been demoralized to some degree. The world is not so kind to people after they're, you know, 24.
Yes, exactly. It's like the movie The Intern. Like,
Yeah, right.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. So good stuff. All's good. Yeah.
Good.
No complaints. A couple of fun things coming up. Birthdays are in May.
Oh, yeah. Your birthday.
Yeah, and Chris's.
Oh, Chris's
too. Big one. It's a milestone birthday.
No way.
Yeah.
30?
No. 30. Yes, 30 plus. I'm Robin
you
the Cradle.
You cougar.
I know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, so some fun things to look forward to going to Lake Arrowhead in a week and a half. So that'll be great. I'll tell you more about that next week.
Cool.
Okay, so all's good?
Everything good.
All right, so we had some fabulous guests last week from the movie Prison Dogs.
That was so interesting. I couldn't stop thinking about it for the next couple of days about just how wonderful what they're doing is. I mean, it really makes such an impact, and I mean, it helps so many people. It's a win-win. You know, it's a win-win for the prisoners. It's a win-win for the veterans and for the organization and for society as a whole.
Absolutely. So if you missed that show, it's really a story of love, loss, redemption. Prison Dogs focuses on the impact of a unique dog training program that gives two marginalized populations in our society a better chance, prison inmates and veterans. Very exceptional.
Fantastic.
Really cool. Yeah. Well, without further ado, we have a very exciting guest today that is somebody I've known for many years, a colleague, and just an all-around great guy. Today we have Dr. Matthew Torrington, the medical director at the Common Ground Independence-Free Clinic in Santa Monica, California, the chief of addiction medicine at the Avalon Malibu Residential Treatment Center in Malibu, California, and a consulting addiction medicine physician at Cry Help in North Hollywood. Dr. Torrington maintains a private practice focusing on the longitudinal disease management of difficult addiction and pain cases. His clinical focus is on the treatment of stimulant dependence, alcohol dependence, opiate dependence, and pain. A participant in the development and implementation of significant research studies, he's served as principal investigator, co-investigator, or study physician on numerous clinical trials. Dr. Torrington is boarded by the American Academy of Family Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, also a member of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and so many other credits, but let's just talk to him instead. Welcome, Dr. Torrington.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. I was just trying to figure this out. I think that I met you in 2009 at a different recovery center named Seasons out in Malibu.
Yep.
Long
back
time
in the day,
ago.
That was at the old Seas Candy House right there on PCH, and it was
right.
A beautiful spot.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, and I was always just looked up to you. You have a great presence, and you're so smart, but you're not so arrogant like so many other doctors.
I wasn't until that introduction and how nice you're being to me. Now I'm going to be totally arrogant. I mean, how am I supposed to recover from that?
Oh, well, anyway, thank you so much for joining us out of your busy day, because we are going to bombard you with questions. Because there's so much controversy these days in the whole world of addiction in terms of what are appropriate treatments, what really helps, you know, what doesn't, what's just commercialism to make the buck but is really not helping anybody. So I want to get into all those things. But first and foremost, how did you get interested in the field of addiction?
That's a really good question. So I don't know. I'm just one of those people. I've always wanted to be a doctor, and I never really knew what kind of doctor I wanted to be. And I was sort of taught, like I was always asked doctors about being a doctor. And remember one of my favorite lessons I learned was from this guy who lived not too far from us. And he said, hey, the first 2 years of medical school are a vocabulary lesson. And the second 2 years are where you figure out what you want to do. And about, you know, in my second 2 years, about halfway through your second 2 year period, they're like, well, what are you going to do? And I really didn't know. And I had this kind of existential crisis of sort of what should I do, and I didn't know. And so at that time I chose OBGYN because my mom is a labor and delivery nurse and my stepdad is a solo practice OBGYN, and it was very diverse. I got to do surgery, which I was really good at, and I got to do outpatient, and I got to be in the hospital, and I got to deliver babies. And then you know, about halfway through my intern year, it turned out that I was going to get married to my wife, who was becoming a dermatologist. And I just couldn't see being an OBGYN, never being home, working twice as hard, making half as much money. I was like, this doesn't work. Like, I need to do something different. So I switched into family medicine. And during my family medicine training, I think that's really where things got galvanized, because I thought, family medicine is going to be where they do prevention. Family medicine is where they're going to do all this good stuff. And then I got to family medicine, and I wasn't really that enthused with the whole situation. In fact, I remember one really serious addiction. She was a pain patient, but a drug addict, who was in my patient population. And I learned all this pharmacology from her, because she'd say, can I have this? And I'd say, no, you can't have that. And she'd say, how about this? And I'd look it up and say, no, you can't have that. She knew everything. She was brilliant. And she knew, like, what time of day the interns had the pager and when to call and what to ask for and how to make it easy for people, because she'd been enabled by the resident system for a long time. Yeah. And as I started figuring her out, I'm like, this is not right. Uh-huh. So I cased her with the program director at one point, and he goes, oh, I got it. She's an addict. We should fire her. That was the treatment, was to fire the patient. And of course, like, me being like the jerk that I, you know, I was just like, no. I refused. I'm like, no, I'm not firing her. Like, that is not happening. And he was like, no, that's what we're going to do. And I'm like, no, actually, I refuse to fire her. So, of course, I got in trouble for insubordination and all this other stuff. But I did refuse to fire her. And I thought, you know what? Like, if this is it, if this is the best we have, like, we've got to do more about this problem.
Yeah.
And so I just started learning more and more. And then I found out about the addiction medicine certification process, which started through the California Society of Addiction Medicine, and then got past the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and then got past the American Board of Addiction Medicine. And so I engaged in that process. I started learning more and more. I started working in a methadone clinic and learning about methadone. And then when I moved to California, I got a job doing clinical research. And that really turned out to be an opportunity to learn about cutting edge technologies and the research process. And I think that was really good, because it empowered me, you know, to have better tools.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah, this is amazing. So whatever happened, did you end up working with the patient? Or did they say?
I kept her, yeah. And then they said they were going to fire her when I graduated. But I kept, you know, and I basically just, it was the dawn of the information age. Like, so we had EMRs, and I was able to use the computer to sort of start to learn about things. And I just was like, no, you can't have this, you can't have that. Uh-huh. And I was trying to manage her pain without fueling her addiction.
Yeah.
And it was a process, you know. you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we have some really just poignant questions, because I know these are questions that I hear from people all the time and I answer in my own way. But what is the difference between addiction and dependency?
Okay, that's a good question. So we kind of divide it into two separate things. Like, on the one hand, there's physical dependence. And it doesn't matter what kind of personality you have, who you live with, like how smart you are, whatever. If you take enough of certain drugs for a long enough period of time, you will become physically dependent. Okay?
Yes.
And physically dependent means that if you have... if you take an antagonist, or you discontinue the medication, you're going to have withdrawal from those drugs. And that has nothing to do with your personality. That has nothing to do with anything like that. And addiction is really where we start to get the aberrant behavior, right? And all those criteria that help us make the DSM diagnoses of use, misuse, or mild, moderate, and severe use disorders for different substances all have to do with the psychological factors associated with exposure to drugs. Okay. Yeah. So, and those things are like, continued use despite knowing that you're harming yourself. Continued use despite the fact that you know that you're hurting your relationships, unsuccessful attempts to cut down, psychologic issues, relationship issues, use in risky situations, spending large amounts of time trying to use or recover from using or getting drugs, failure to fulfill roles in work, home, or school, craving, you know, all those sort of things, which are not physiologic manifestations of exposure. They're more like psychosocial manifestations of exposure.
I see.
So it's possible for people to be physically dependent without having any of the psychosocial factors. Does that make sense?
And you can also be an addict without being dependent.
Right.
Correct. You can have all of those psychosocial like manifestations without being physically dependent, without having physical withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then like for stimulants are sort of a good example. It's like people can be horribly dependent on stimulants, but the withdrawal is really just being really tired and sleeping a little more than usual. It's not like there's a horrible constellation of physical symptoms, you know, as compared to opiate dependence, for instance, when people who are severely dependent stop, they can get this awful constellation of physical problems, right? But it can be just as psychosocially incapacitating, if not more.
So I'm curious what models that you personally use to treat addiction, knowing your research and things like that.
My model is extremely simple.
Okay.
I believe that it is comprehensive, individualized, multimodal treatment over time, which gives people the best chance of sustained success. And by that, I mean a tailored biologic, psychological, social, spiritual, and nutritional regimen that evolves with the progress of the patient. Okay. And applying a disease management model, which is more like instead of seeing addiction as a gunshot wound, oh, we just need to get the bullet out and you're going to be all better. Like, you know, getting the bullet out is important, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't keep you from getting shot in the first place or from getting shot again.
Right. True.
And so the key is a lot more for me about staying sober than getting sober. Although, you know, and I used to think like I would detox somebody and I would think I was so cool and smart and, you know, and the patient's off, but it doesn't ever keep it. You know, my research mentor is this old Chinese guy and he says, detox is good for a lot of things. Keeping people off of drugs isn't one of them.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like the idea is, you know, great, but how do you keep it going? And I also think, you know, my private practice motto, which I started back, you know, in like 2007, was this longitudinal disease management model of a decade with me at retail is supposed to cost less than 1 month in promises or passages in a private room, right? Yeah. And the idea is I kept seeing these people, and actually happened at Seasons, the first time I remember, where there was a patient and I was talking to his family after he discharged, and they're like, we spent all our money on Seasons. We don't have money for him to see a therapist. We don't have money for him to get his medication filled. We don't have anything. And he didn't have any health insurance. And I was like, what a bad investment. Mm. Like, it's not that he didn't get something out of the experience of being in residential. It's just that it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Right.
And if you're trying to like win, you need to have more of a longitudinal strategy than like, oh, I know what we're going to do for 30 or 60 days, and then I have no idea what we're going to do. You need to think about it as more of a long-term thing, because that's more likely to get you what you need.
Absolutely. And as you know, that I spent a great deal of my time at Seasons nurturing and nourishing the family systems model, because I found that that was so incredibly important, was to have the support
so
system
important.
And the awareness mm-hmm. of the people around you in your life. So many people, they do this in isolation. It's like, oh, my husband's an addict, he's getting help. And then they don't do anything to foster the integration back into the relationship.
Sure.
Right. And then, so what happens is, because they don't do that, the relationship ends up dying.
Sure.
Right, of course.
Because they don't, they were relating on the old paradigm, and then the one person comes back to the new paradigm, and the other person is like, huh?
Sure.
Like,
there's a lot of built up resentment, and of course, yeah, feelings for the other person.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. So complex and always different. And that's the other thing, is like, people always ask me like, well, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do for you in your particular situation. I'm going to try and assess the situation, and I'm going to constantly try and tailor the program based on what you need then.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you need at day zero is different from what you need at day 30, at day 60, at day 90, at day 180, at 1 year, at 1.5 years, at 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that addiction is a disease characterized by relapse. And to me, it makes a lot more sense to keep it away and to try and stay engaged over time than it is to just hope it's never going to come back and then be surprised and destroyed when it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you of the philosophy that once an addict, always an addict in all different drug arenas? Or have you seen people who, you know, maybe they had a stimulant addiction and, you know, they lick that and they're, you know, pretty much drug free for years, but they dabble here and there and smoke a little weed or have a couple drinks? Or does it always turn into the decline on anything?
I mean, you're always wrong. And you're, when you say always,
sure.
Right?
Always, primarily,
never,
usually,
just always wrong, right?
Right, of course.
They're all. I'm just saying. So my point is that,
but
like,
that
every
is
person is different, and every
right.
and people have psychological reasons, social reasons, spiritual reasons, nutritional reasons, and biologic reasons why they end up losing control. And it really just depends on the individual and their experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, mm-hmm. I can tell you that you're definitely at higher risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but there's no way to say that, like, you know, because people have these experiences, and although I wouldn't advise people to re-expose themselves to things that have the potential to be super dangerous for them, it doesn't mean that they don't and that there aren't people who haven't had that experience. It's just a question of what's the risk-benefit ratio on that, and is it worth it when you consider that, you know, you've got, you know, impulse control disorders are like the most costly and difficult and damaging thing to society, and we dramatically under care for them.
Yes.
You know, it's just a question of like, really, why is that so important, and what could we offer? What other tools could you use to get the same things, which are sustainable and more helpful for you?
I have another question too. When you were talking about impulse disorders, I guess how many of what percentage would you say of all the clients that you see have some other mental health issue? Is it personality issue? Is it
depression?
Exactly.
Yeah, post-traumatic stress.
Totally. Yeah. I'm curious, kind of, what percent for you?
So that's a great question, right? And I would say that if you really look hard, everybody has some form of impulse control issues. They're just better at, some people are better at managing it than others.
Mm.
And so there's really just more of a question, like, we all kind of fight with our limbic brains about like what we should do and what's best for us and what we do actually, right?
Uh-huh.
And then in my practice, I probably end up with a higher percentage of people with comorbidity or comorbid psychiatric diagnoses, because I tend to focus on the most difficult stuff, right? I end up with, like, you know, patients who have already failed treatment with somebody else, or they've, you know, they've really been struggling and they need more. And usually those people are facing double jeopardy, where they have an, you know, they have some sort of addiction problem and they had psychiatric comorbidity, which just makes it sometimes more than twice as hard for them.
Sure.
Because you got to manage both simultaneously to give people the best chance of success.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I'm curious your thoughts about 12-step programs.
In general, I think 12-step is the single most powerful force in the universe, helping people not die from addiction. It's available in every city in the world every day of the week, and it's very prolific, and it provides many people incredible help. I also think that, like, diet and exercise is the most important thing for treating diabetes.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that medical testing and medication and other things aren't important for diabetes care. Mm-hmm. It just shows that, you know, that diet and exercise is incredibly important. Moreover, the analogy that I think about for AA lately that I think has been incredibly useful is that AA is like the grocery store, okay? And that every store you go to is a little bit different every time because they have different products depending on what's in season and what they have and where you are, right? B, everybody comes to the store for something and everyone leaves the store with something different. When you study AA, what you find is that people get a lot of different stuff there. Some people get a social outlet. Some people get somebody to follow. Some people get someone to lead. Some people get some low-grade psychology. Some people get a spiritual connection. Some people just get, you know, a place to be and something to do. Some people, you know, there's all these different things that people get. Men and women tend to get different stuff. Just like if you stand outside the grocery store, everybody's bags have different things in them. Right. So it's just about, and by the way, there's some terrible stuff at the grocery store. Right. And just because they sell Cheetos and vodka doesn't mean you shouldn't go there. It just means you need to keep that stuff out of your cart.
I love this analogy.
So it's about taking what you need and leaving the rest and really finding the right stores or the right meetings for you. Because, you know, there are people who would do poorly in a giant meeting with 80 people who would do amazing in a small meeting with six people.
Right.
You know, and or single sex meetings. And that's why it's cool that there are so many different flavors of meetings. And especially in a city like LA, we're blessed to have thousands of different meetings a week. Mm-hmm. It's just like the fact that we have thousands of different restaurants and different stores where you can just literally find anything you want. It's there. You just have to go look for it.
Right.
Oh, that's really beautiful.
I love that analogy.
Yeah,
really, I can see that, yeah.
But there is the whole controversy out there, though, as well, that really just using a 12-step model in terms of for, quote, treatment has the worst success rate of anything.
I am absolutely against unimodal treatment.
Okay. Right.
I don't think anybody with a severe addiction problem should be getting medicine only, should be getting therapy only, should be getting social or 12-step only, should be getting nutritional only, or should be getting spiritual only treatment. And as a favor as I am of every one of those things individually, just exposing people to one mode is not fair.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's, to me, and that's one of the problems that I have, is that you've got this severe life-threatening brain disease and you don't ever get to see a licensed professional.
Right.
Right? Like, you know, or we have the people with the most severe illness. Like, in the way I look at addiction, like, suppose we take two patients and they both admit to the emergency room. One is detoxing off of heroin and the other had a heart attack. And they're both really, really sick, right? I would venture that if you look through the biopsychosocial lens, the patient who had the heart attack, even though they are on the verge of death from like their heart muscle dying, they are much less sick than the addict because they still have their job, they still have money in the bank, they still have their relationships, they still have their friends, they still have their family, they have everything else about them. Whereas the person who's finally showing up for treatment who needs detox has an annihilated psychosocial situation 9 times out of 10, and they are so much sicker and the path back is so much harder for them. an idea that this really sick person doesn't get access to the most professionally trained and best qualified licensed professionals just doesn't seem fair. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why we get such bad outcomes.
True.
Yeah, very true.
Very, very good point. So part of why I wanted you on the show more than anything is I know you're just a genius when it comes to explaining to people how the brain works. And once somebody has become an addict, and I'm not going to get this quite right, but I remember carrying forward with me something that you once said about when you're 5 years old and you're tossing a ball with your dad or your mom or your friend, you get like a big reward for that. You feel good in the brain. Later on, as life kind of goes along, you know, that reward isn't quite as strong. When you introduce something like cocaine or heroin or something, all of a sudden you can't feel any of those $5 rewards or those $10 rewards. It's like throwing $1 million in your account and then taking it away. Did I get that close?
That's pretty close. Okay. The idea there, and you did pretty well.
Okay.
The concept is that first we have to set the table a little bit, though, in order to explain this appropriately. And
perfect.
The first thing we're going to do is we're going to divide the brain into three basic parts. The front of your brain, with your new or neocortex, right, which is actually in the front part of your head, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the part of the brain that makes us the dynamic, amazing, wonderful creatures that we are as Homo sapiens. All of the things that you identify as you, your personality, your memories, your creativity, you know, all that's in your neocortex. And you have executive control over your neocortex. Do I stay on the show or do I log off? Do I turn the channel or not? Do I stand up or sit down? Do I speak or do I remain silent? Do I call in or not call in? Those are all choices that you make with your neocortex. And you have control of that part of your brain. In the back of your brain, like at the back of your neck, right, that's where your brainstem and your cerebellum is. And that's where all sorts of stuff happens that your brain controls, but you have no executive control over. Like, that's what controls your pancreas and your liver and your spleen and your bone marrow and your kidneys. You know, and I think I'm pretty smart, but I have no idea how to control my gallbladder, right? I mean, like, but my brain is taking care of that without my executive control.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So you have these distinct parts of your brain, lots of control and no control. Lots of control in the front, no control in the back. And in the middle is a constellation of brain structures that we call the limbic brain, L-I-M-B-I-C, the limbic brain. And that's like the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area and the substantia nigra and the amygdala. And this part of the brain, this constellation of structures together motivates all humans on the planet to breathe more frequently than we eat, more frequently than we sleep, more frequently than we have sex. That's what we do. Humans have to breathe, eat, sleep, and have sex to get more humans, and we're awesome at it, right? Mm-hmm. We're amazing at breathing, eating, sleeping, and having sex. That's why there's so many of us, because we're fantastic at getting this done, right? And this part of your brain is connected to the way the limbic brain is connected to the way that you think and the way that you feel to get you to do this stuff, right? You cannot hold your breath until you die. Because even if you're an angry 8-year-old, right, you could hold your breath just so long. And eventually, if you're amazing at holding your breath, your limbic brain will shut down your neocortex. You will lose consciousness and you'll start breathing again.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Because your limbic brain is programmed for survival. Okay. And the sailor who's stranded at sea knows he's been trained not to drink the seawater.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, he just gets so thirsty. He gets manipulated by his limbic brain, right? And it makes him think it's going to be okay for whatever reason. And he feels so thirsty and he can drink the seawater to his own demise. That's not what he's hoping for. But the limbic brain is able to affect literally the way we think and the way that we feel. And it responds to dopamine, the currency of reward. You get about a penny for a breath. You get a quarter for food. You get 50 cents for sleep. You get a dollar or two for sex, depending on how that goes down. And that's the normal dopamine economy of life. Dollars and cents.
Right.
Dollars and cents. Say it again.
I said, or you lose her a dollar or two, depending on where you're having sex.
Oh, I guess. But it's supposed to feel good. That's why it's so reinforcing. And that's supposed to be like the max payout. And the idea is that the dopamine helps assign saliency in the brain to these events. So the brain knows that it's important. So I should try and replicate that event again in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And where this is where you were getting into is these drugs of abuse can overwhelm the dopamine system with methamphetamine paying $1,000, or concentrated opiates paying $800, or cocaine paying $300, alcohol paying $5 a drink. That can really manipulate the system over time so that your survival center starts to think that survival is equated with re-exposure to these drugs. And what's terrifying is that the limbic brain can manipulate the way you think and the way you feel. It can give you fevers, chills, sweats, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, runny nose, watery eyes, muscle pain, bone pain, joint pain, restlessness, agitation, insomnia, irritability, craving. And it can rewrite your teleprompter Ron Burgundy style to get you to say and think things that don't make any sense, that are more consistent with you continuing to get loaded than you staying sober.
Wow.
Because your autopilot is corrupted. Right? And that's really scary to have your autopilot be corrupted. Now, the good news is that most of the time your manual controls still work. So you can make executive decisions, but you have to work at it, because as soon as you stop making executive decisions and you revert to your autopilot, you're likely to get led astray again by the wrong part of your brain.
So I have a question in regard. That was a fantastic explanation. I have a question.
It was a long answer to a short
It was fascinating. But I guess while you're talking, I was thinking that, why is it that certain people are addicted to certain substances or certain, like, gambling, overeating? Is it their parts of their brain?
Great question. So the theory on that is that each person's brain has all these different locks. Right? And there are certain keys that turn the locks in some people, and those keys don't work on other people. It just has to do with your genetic sensitivity. Like, you know, like, some people have trouble staying at their ideal body weight, others have none.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of Americans are overweight, and almost half are obese. I would say there isn't a 300-pound woman alive who wants to weigh 300 pounds. But the wrong part of her brain is manipulating the way she thinks and the way she feels to get her to continue to consume more calories than she can burn. Why? Because something about the constellation of variables that she's been getting exposed to has this wrong part of her brain activated. And, you know, if you really interview people closely, most people have been exposed to a lot of stuff. They've been exposed to alcohol. They've been exposed to some stimulant. They've been exposed to nicotine. They've been exposed to some pain medicine. They've been exposed to some form of anxiolytic. And most people don't have a problem with most of those things. But certain people get exposed, and it really turns their locks and manipulates the wrong part of their brain and in a distinct way, which can be very disabling.
Yeah. And are there other neurotransmitters aside from dopamine that play a significant role also in tricking our brains and overriding things?
Well, I mean, yes, for sure. We think about serotonin as being associated with anxiety, compulsivity, and dysphoria. We think about norepinephrine as being associated with get up and go. And then, you know, we think about GABA, or gamma-aminobutyric acid, as the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter system, which is sort of associated with mounting an inhibitory response. And that can be really a major player as well, because, you know, at a certain point, changes in your GABA system sort of affects your brakes and your ability to stop. And I think that a lot of times genetic sensitivity in the GABA system can play a huge role, because some people are born with big truck brakes, okay, and they have no problem, almost no matter what load they get exposed to, they can stop whenever they want because they've got these really big truck brakes. And some people have little tiny car brakes, and they get exposed to some load that would be no big deal for a truck, but right away their brakes are wearing out. And then I feel like that your environment that you're in, depending on how much stress and trauma you have, that's like whether you have a, if you have a lot of stress and trauma, that's like living in San Francisco, and you have like none, that's living in somewhere totally flat. And that, that interplay between your genetic resiliency, your environment, and what you get exposed to informs some of this stuff about why people can use and stop and use and stop and use and stop for a long time. And then as they get older, sometimes they start to lose their resiliency, and the alcohol that used to be no big deal for them now is starting to be a big problem.
So we are talking with Dr. Matthew Torrington. He is an addiction expert and researcher, and he's just really amazing explaining all this. So I have a question about sort of natural things to help treat addiction. Or, and I know you spoke a lot about nutrition. And can you speak a little bit about the role of vitamins and other things that are natural to help out?
I mean, I think that, like, to start with, you know, we have to make sure that we're fueling our bodies with the most healthy things available. And, you know, the food industry and the massive explosion in processed and artificial things that we consume, it turns out that, like, some people can tolerate that stuff pretty well, and some people just don't. And so on the one hand, and by the way, compared to people who are true experts at this, naturopaths and nutritionists, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm as sharp on it as the sharpest. But a big picture, my big picture concepts are, number one, like, avoid processed foods, mm-hmm. partially hydrogenated fatty acids, the things that make a Twinkie stay fresh forever, they're bad.
Disgusting.
They're bad for you, and that the more whole foods you can consume, the more actual fresh fruits and vegetables, the more healthy grains you can get exposed to, the better, and the less processed foods, the better. I don't know if it's possible for people to really never get exposed to any processed foods, yeah. but less is more when it comes to processed foods, number one. Number two, water, mm. right? Like, water is like the best thing you can possibly drink. So avoiding, like, high glycemic index sugary beverages, avoiding soda, really trying to make sure that you start giving your body enough water. The solution to pollution is dilution. So just getting a healthy amount of water can make a huge difference in your body's ability to get rid of toxins, mm-hmm. you know, so less processed foods, more, you know, and then obviously the more locally sourced, the more you can know about what you're eating, the better. And then, you know, there's a lot of focus right now on reducing the amount of, like, meat that you're consuming, right? Because not only is it energetically more difficult for the planet, mm-hmm. but it's more work for your body to process. And then I'm not saying no meat or anything like that, but, like, making sure that we're sort of, you know, we're reorienting our food pyramid to be, you know, less grains and more fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. and really making sure that our meat and protein is in appropriate amounts and not going too big into that, like, unlike, you know, typical American portions and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. The more we study them, the more positive results we find. The biochemists, the stingiest namers on the planet, refer to these guys as essential fatty acids,
yeah.
not super awesome fatty acids, essential fatty acids. Mm-hmm. Why are they essential? Because we can't make them. And we used to get them from fresh-pressed grains, because you had to fresh-press the grains because they'd go rancid if you didn't. But now all the grains get processed and partially hydrogenated, so they stay stable for longer, and so they don't need to be fresh pressed, and the omega-3s are wiped out by the partially hydrogenated fatty acids. Mm-hmm. So the idea is supplementing with some omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids can be really good. And, you know, it turns out that, like, the fish oil sometimes can be contaminated with heavy metals. So I'm more of a fan of the algae-based or the flax-based omega-3 and omega-6 supplementation, which can have benefits for depression and all sorts of other things. Those are normal constituents of every cell wall. They're very important. You know, and then making sure that you're taking a multivitamin, which is probably a great investment. And then after that, the supplement situation just goes, I mean, explodes, right? There's thousands of different supplements, all have claims about what they do, and they're not really substantiated the way that we substantiate medical claims and medicines, and they're not regulated by the FDA. So on all of those, I just sort of take a wait and see attitude. I'm very open to almost everything, but I'm really not positive about anything. And, you know, like Alan Leshner said, there are no bad medicines and there are no bad people. There are bad combinations of medicine and people. So it's about, like, finding what combinations are going to work best for each individual.
That's awesome. And I would love to just provide kind of a real life scenario that I've encountered in my practice a lot. I know you have, Kelly, and just out in the world, this just seems to be one of the very common experiences for people. So you have somebody who's basically, just an example, who's in a lot of pain. They weren't typically an addict. They weren't addicted to substances, but they're having a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. Go to the doctor. They're given all kinds of opiates. Pain gets worse. They withdraw from the opiates. They consider that to be more about the pain, not the withdrawal from the pain from the withdrawal. So they take more. The doctors freely prescribe. They get more and more. They get multiple doctors to prescribe more. Yada, yada, yada. The next thing you know, this person is completely not functioning anymore. And then they go to, let's say, rehab or treatment, et cetera. And then, you know, now they're back with the pain. So they're sober and they have pain. Can you speak to that? Because that's such a common scenario, and I'm sure you've seen it hundreds of thousands of times.
So hard. It's so hard. So first of all, I think of pain like a fire and pain medicine like a fire hose. Okay? So if your house is on fire, bring the fire hose, right? I mean, like, you don't want your house to burn down. But think about what would happen to your house if I went in there with the fire hose right now. It really messes things up.
Yeah.
Can change things for the worse. And so there's this really, the opiates are really dangerous, but they really can do something important in the setting of acute pain. We went through a huge change between 2000 and 2010. And we could probably talk for a whole hour just about this particular constellation of events. But some of the factors that caused this epidemic in prescription opioid overuse had to do with, number one, Congress declared 2000 to 2010 the decade against pain. JACO, the group that certifies hospitals as being legit, made pain the fifth vital sign and basically started to rate hospitals based on how well they treated pain. The FDA allowed medicines to be advertised on television for the first time around 2000. So medicine went from being this scary stuff that you didn't know about to being a product that you could get just like any other product. Right?
Yeah, makes sense.
Also, the internet, right? It used to be, if you wanted to know about medicines, you had to have a copy of the PDR, the physician's desk reference, the largest book in the world, basically, right? And it was expensive. The book cost hundreds of dollars. No one had it. So you couldn't just know everything about every drug. And then there's the internet. And now you can read about every drug and know about it right away.
Yes.
Okay? All of these things are changing the way people think about medication and their relationship with it. Also, right around 2000, doctor-patient relationship goes through a radical transformation. Prior to that, and you know, it was happening over time, but doctors had these longitudinal relationships with patients. Now, all of a sudden, with change in healthcare, the doctor is the guy at the window, right? It's much easier to lie to the guy at the window than it is to lie to the person who you've known and knows your mom and knows your aunt and knows your sister.
So true, right?
So all these things are changing. There was a patient in residential who put it really well. He said, "Oxycontin stole my generation." I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "I would have never tried heroin. It just sounded bad. It's just something that I knew I would not do. But take a pill? How bad can a pill be? It's just a pill."
Such a good point.
And a doctor,
and that's really part. That's right. That's really part of the challenge that we got sucked into. And all these things. Oh, and I forgot one crucial variable. In 2002, a doctor in California got convicted of battery for the undertreatment of pain. One case, but like a shot heard around the world. Now, all of a sudden, the doctor has in the back of their mind, if this guy says it hurts and I don't go along with it and treat them, I can be in trouble.
Whoa. Oh my God, that's incredible.
And we know that doctors don't like to be in trouble.
No.
Doctors don't, you know, and by the way, the more, you know, the more litigious and aggressive and demanding the patient is, the more the doctor is afraid of getting in trouble, the more it gives the advantage to the patient.
Yeah.
Oh, and remember, the part of your brain that wants you to keep taking opiates, it can affect the way you think and the way you feel. So it can say, oh yeah, I have a lot of pain and I have these symptoms. Oh, and this is what you need to say and this is how you need to say it to get what you need.
Got it.
Okay, so back to your original question about what do you do for somebody who's had these problems, and the key is comprehensive, individualized, multimodal pain management. Right? Because there are all sorts of things we can do to help with pain. Opiates are one of them, but they're not the only thing, right? There's a whole host of medications which can work on the GABA system or on the brain, on neurotransmitters. And then there's all sorts of physical, you know, there's non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. There are topical treatments. There are all sorts of biologic things we can do. In addition to eating a less inflammatory diet, to exercising regularly, to using mind-body activities, meditation, and guided imagery to help you process and deal with the pain in a safer way, to get therapy that sort of help you get better at dealing with it, to be in group with other people who have pain. Like, there are so many different things that you can do, like acupuncture, massage, so many things that can be done, physical therapy, all that can help treat pain, but they all take more time and are harder to implement than writing somebody a prescription, which you can do in less than a minute.
It's good so answer. True. Thank you so much.
And it's about changing the focus from this one simple thing that works really well but has all these side effects to trying to have a more individualized, more comprehensive, and more multimodal strategy.
Amazing.
It also seems to be like just humbling oneself around whatever one's condition is and some of the limitations. Because there, I know people who they're like a gymnast or they're a runner or they're whatever, and they have injuries and they want to keep running, so they keep taking the pills so they don't feel the pain, but they're actually further exacerbating their actual condition.
Yeah.
So kind of changing your your relationship to yourself and your conditions is so critical.
So true.
Well,
absolutely. And it's hard to give up the things that you love. It's hard to give up, you know. I mean, I recently had to give up playing basketball. I play basketball every week as long as I can remember, but like with my shoulder and my knee, it's just not, you know, it's just not realistic.
Yeah.
Right. And I wish I could have been one of those guys that got to play into my 60s, but you know what? I'm not.
Right.
Okay. I'm just going to have to take what I got. And by the way, until orthopedics gets a little bit better, like, I'm not ready to get a joint replacement. I'm not ready to go down that road. Like, I think it's, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, stick to lower impact things for now. It's just the way it is.
Maybe swimming.
I was thinking swimming, golf. You know.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, you will not believe it, but we have hit our time. Can you believe it? It went like so fast.
So interesting. Really. When, where can people find you and your website and all that good stuff?
DrTorrington.com, and it's pretty easy to find. I'm pretty Googleable. And, you know, I mean, it's like, and I would say it's not like I can see everybody who needs help, right? It's, but the key is that everybody should be trying to be an informed consumer and making sure that they're getting multimodal treatment and that they're realistic about how long these things take, that no one is going to be cured in 30, 60, or 90 days, regardless of what the billboards say, right? And just make sure to be an educated consumer and to put your needs first, and then also to think about it more of a marathon than a sprint.
I love that. Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's a process, not an event.
Thank you so much.
We so appreciate
it. Thank you, Dr. Matthew Torrington. So appreciate
No problem.
Okay, talk
bye-bye.
Soon.
All right, well, that's about it.
We're out of time, everybody. Have a great week, and till next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.